And hello, SunSounds listeners. This is Andy Bobick, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that I've been reading now for a couple weeks, titled The 57 Bus. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Thunder and the Noise Storms. And then it's Sylvester's Letter, Dancing with Granddad, Extra Yarn, Life is Beautiful, and if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with The Bear Who Loved to Dance. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled Thunder and the Noise Storms. Noise storms at school are the worst. On Monday, there was a big storm. It started on the bus, with all the kids laughing and waving at the cars driving past, trying to get them to honk their horns. Honk, honk, honk. I got that funny feeling in my body, and my brain felt woozy. At school, everyone was talking, and all the jackets, shoes, and backpacks scraped and swished as the other kids put them in their cubbies. All that racket made me grumpy. In music class on Tuesday, my friends were singing at the top of their lungs. When the teacher said we could use the instruments, my head felt like it would explode. I pulled up my hoodie so I could be by myself. Gym class on Wednesday was rough. Sneakers squeaking, the teacher blowing the whistle, and the balls bouncing. Boom, boom, boom. I couldn't stay there one more second. I was so mad. I kicked the ball as hard as I could. It hit the bench and knocked over all the water bottles. Recess was even tougher. When the bell rang and the kids ran to line up, someone bumped me. I yelled at everyone to leave me alone. The kids backed away and stared. I felt so alone. I hid in the play structure, covering my ears. The principal called my Mosum to come help. By the time Mosum got there, I was crying and embarrassed. Mosum said, "When you're ready, Thunder, you can come down. I'll just wait here." It got quiet when everyone went back into the school. I climbed down, and at the bottom of the slide, Mosum was waiting. He smiled and said, "Let's go for a walk." I love walks with Mosum. After a while, he asked, "Thunder, why were you hiding?" I told him that sometimes things get too noisy. "It's just so loud, and I can't stand it." Mosum nodded. "It's like that for me, too, sometimes." He explained that when he was a little boy, his father taught him a special word to help him with noise storms. The word is Mama Askana Wit Awi. It means to listen and wonder. Mosum said, "Sometimes life is noisy, and sometimes life is wonderful, especially when you listen to the quiet things. There is wonder all around us." I tried to listen to the quiet things Mosum spoke about, but I didn't hear anything. I still felt stormy. My face was hot, and my skin felt scratchy. All I heard was the swing set, screeching in the breeze. Mosum closed his eyes. Then he said, "Thunder, thunder, listen with wonder. Can you hear our relative, the wind? The wind is singing a soothing song." I stopped to listen again. It was hard at first. I only heard annoying songs, the flag whipping, a door banging, and the gravel grinding under my feet. I closed my eyes, and then I heard it. Whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. The wind song made me happy. I could feel the song in my skin. Mosum looked around. Can you hear the trees? Listen closely. The branches moved slowly. I could hear them creak and sway. I could hear the leaves, too. They were clapping and giving each other high fives. I giggled. What about the squirrels, Thunder? I listened closely, just as Mosum. I heard them talking to us. I thought they said hello. Mosum waved at the squirrels and said, Tensi, little friends. Then he pointed to the sky. Listen to the birds fly. I heard their wings flapping and swooping. Mosum asked if I could hear their strength. As I watched them move in the sky, I felt stronger. Mosum looked towards the river and said, Sometimes the waters are loud, but today the river is quiet. I wonder what the river is saying. I paused to listen and thought that maybe the river was saying to slow down. I asked Mosum if we could walk a little slower. Yes, Thunder, that's a good idea, he said. Can you hear the sweet grass whispers? Mosum asked. I heard them say that there's a lot going on, but everything was going to be okay. I wondered if Mosum heard them too. Mosum said, There is a lot going on, Thunder, but we can face it together. Let's just stand here, quiet and still, Mosum said. Do you hear it? At first, I noticed the cars rumbling past. A siren screamed, and a big dog barked. My body got stiff, and I squeezed my hands. Mosum said, Let's take some deep breaths. Mosum breathed in and out. The sound made me feel better. Mosum asked to hold my hand. I said yes. Then I heard it. It sounded like a drum, a slow and steady drum. Badoom, badoom, badoom. What's that? I asked Mosum. That's your heart, he said. What's your heart saying to you, Thunder? I listened. I think it is saying there is wonder all around us, and inside us, too. Mosum smiled. Let's just sit here, he said. We sat listening to all the quiet sounds. Do you want to go back? Mosum asked. Yes, I told him. I felt ready. I was calm, and the noise storm was gone. We walked back to school, and I joined my friends in class. Today, there was a fire drill. It was a big noise storm. The bells ringing, the kids getting up from their desks, the noisy walk to the safe spot outside, and the roll call. It was really, really, really loud. I started to get that funny feeling again. I took some deep breaths and listened for the quiet sounds. I remembered what Mosum said. Thunder, thunder, listen with wonder. Even with all the noise around me, I could still listen to my heart. Sylvester's letter. Some letters can't be delivered in the usual way, but I have a plan. And here's his letter to Gigi, greatest grandma. Love, Sylvester. First, I'll make the skydivers breakfast, so they're energized when I high-five them onto the plane. That will lift off over the ocean and cruise the coastline with its flapping banner. Until, one by one, they'll take the plunge and form a human flower in midair. Poof! Poof, poof, and there they are, all with their parachutes out, soaring and steering to the top of the train that will snake through fields of fruit trees, all the way to a squawking jungle. Now he's sealing the letter in the envelope, he's putting it into his backpack, he gets on his bike, and he pedals through the mountains. A river packed with piranhas will carry the letter south to the place where the rare pink dolphin wait. And when the moon is full, a single messenger will leap to meet the butterflies that will deliver my letter up, up, up. And his letter is now on a little airplane. And now he is standing on a cliff and he watches the airplane dive down. Dear Gigi, I miss you every day. I always think of you when Mom puts a pickle on my plate. You being the most pickle-loving person I know. And there he is taking his bike back home. Sometimes I hear your voice when I wake up, and doves are singing in the tree outside my window. That coo, roo, coo, coo, coo you used to do so perfectly. And now he's standing outside his house with his bike. Remember how you taught me the names of insects and birds and flowers and trees? Remember when we played in the branches of the old Japanese maple and pretended to be chickadees? And now he's lying down on his front yard. You will always be Gigi to me, but when I look at pictures of you when you were young, I think Georgina suits you too. Your haircut cracks me up. And he's still lying down on the lawn. I wonder where you are now, and if you could see me and Mom making your favorite chocolate cake on your birthday. I wrote your name in blue icing, and of course, we ate it a la mode. And now a butterfly lands right on his face. And he wakes up, and the butterfly flies off. I was thinking today that you are one of my favorite people of all time, and the most fun. Now he climbs into bed. I love you forever, Sylvester. And then the next picture, he's sitting at the dinner table with a book opened up that says, How to Pickle, Canning Made Easy, Comprehensive Guide to Pickling. Dancing with Granddad, an Alzheimer's story for children and their families. Every day after school, Nia raced home. Every day at 3 o'clock, Granddad anxiously waited for her. They played music, and Nia placed her feet gently upon Granddad's. Together they danced and danced. But today, when Nia turned on the music, Granddad squinted his eyes and insisted, It's bedtime. Bedtime? It's only 3 o'clock, Nia said. Of course it is, my little Nia. I couldn't see the clock without my glasses. On Fridays, the smell of Granddad's favorite cookies filled the house. Nia listened as Granddad repeated his stories about growing up at his lake house. Granddad licked the last crumb from his plate. He paused in the middle of his famous fish story. Where are my cookies? He demanded from Mama. A troubled look spread across Mama's face. She knew better than to argue with Granddad. She placed more cookies on his plate. As if the details had fluttered away like a butterfly, Granddad never finished his fish story. But it didn't matter. Nia giggled anyway. She heard the story enough times to know it ended with Granddad falling into the lake. Granddad had recently moved in with Nia and her parents after the doctor said he had Alzheimer's disease. It wasn't safe for Granddad to live by himself anymore. He was too forgetful and often became confused. Nia didn't have a brother or a sister, so she liked having Granddad around. They played games even though Granddad didn't always follow the rules. They sang old songs, the one Granddad knew most of the words to, and every Friday they drove Granddad to the Golden Grovers Senior dance. But on Thursday, Granddad insisted on going to the dance. "Granddad, look, it's only Thursday," Nia said, pointing to the calendar. Granddad scratched his head before stomping off to his room. That same night, Papa found Granddad wandering in the kitchen in his coat. "I'm going to be late for the dance," he yelled. It took some convincing, but Papa was able to dance Granddad back to his room. He tucked him safely back in bed. The next night, Papa drove Granddad to the senior center. Nia and Papa watched through the window as Granddad headed straight for the dance floor. He didn't even stop to take off his coat. A smile spread across Nia's face. But when Nia and Papa returned to pick him up, Granddad was nowhere in sight. Nia's heart sank. Then Nia spotted him. "There he is." He wandered away. Granddad was outside of the senior center, on the corner with his shoes in his hands. He yelled at Papa for being late, even though he wasn't. Nia was not used to Granddad raising his voice. During the ride home, Nia stroked his hand to calm him. The next day after school, Mama and Papa called a meeting. "Granddad's condition seems to be getting worse," Mama told Nia. Tears formed in her eyes. "It's not anyone's fault," Papa quietly explained. "Granddad has Alzheimer's disease, and that will affect his brain. Over time, Alzheimer's makes it harder and harder to remember things. It leads to more and more confusion, so this is to be expected." Papa lifted Nia onto his lap. "We spoke to Granddad's doctor. He suggested Granddad go to a care facility to live." "What's a care facility?" Nia wanted to know. "Well, it's a safe place where they specialize in caring for people like Granddad who have Alzheimer's." "Will he be okay there?" Nia asked. "Of course," Papa said. "He will even make new friends with other people who are a lot like him. And we can visit him all the time." "You can help us choose the perfect place for him," Mama said. The thought of Granddad not living with her saddened Nia. But she knew they had to do what was best for him. It wasn't easy convincing Granddad to move into his new home. Decorating his new bedroom with familiar pictures, photographs, and furniture from home helped. Nia even drew him some new pictures. Every weekend, they brought Granddad his favorite cookies. They played games together, sang songs, and Granddad told his stories. Sometimes on Friday nights, they played music, and even when they didn't, Nia gently placed her feet upon Granddad's. They danced and danced. And while Nia knew Granddad might not remember their time together, Nia always would. Extra Yarn. On a cold afternoon, in a cold little town, where everywhere you looked was either the white of snow or the black of soot from chimneys, Annabelle found a box filled with yarn of every color. So she went home and knit herself a sweater. And when Annabelle was done, she had some extra yarn. So she knit a sweater for Mars, too. Mars is her dog. But there was still extra yarn. And when Annabelle and Mars went for a walk, Nate pointed and laughed and said, "You two look ridiculous." "You're just jealous," said Annabelle. "No, I'm not," said Nate. But it turned out he was. Because now Nate and his dog have a sweater. And even after she'd made a sweater for Nate and his dog, and for herself and for Mars, she still had extra yarn. At school, Annabelle's classmates could not stop talking about her sweater. "Quiet," shouted Mr. Norman. "Quiet, everyone. Annabelle, that sweater of yours is a terrible distraction. I cannot teach with everyone turning around to look at you." "Then I'll knit one for everyone," Annabel said, "so they won't have to turn around." "Impossible," said Mr. Norman. "You can't." But it turned out she could, and she did, even for Mr. Norman. And when she was done, Annabel still had extra yarn. So she knit sweaters for her mom and dad, and for Mr. Pendleton, and Mrs. Pendleton, and for Dr. Palmer, and for little Louise. She made sweaters for everyone, except Mr. Crabtree, who never wore sweaters or even long pants, and who would stand in his shorts with the snow up to his knees. "No sweater for me, thanks," said Mr. Crabtree. So she made Mr. Crabtree a hat, and even then Annabel still had extra yarn. She made sweaters for all the dogs and all the cats and for other animals too. Soon, people thought, soon Annabel will run out of yarn. But it turned out she didn't. So Annabel made sweaters for things that didn't even wear sweaters. Things began to change in that little town. Now all the houses have, like, sweaters. News spread of this remarkable girl who never ran out of yarn, and people came to visit from around the world to see all the sweaters and to shake Annabel's hand. One day, an archduke, who was very fond of clothes, sailed across the sea and demanded to see Annabel. "Little girl," said the archduke, "I would like to buy that miraculous box of yarn, and I'm willing to offer you $1,000,000.
"No, thank you," said Annabel, who was knitting a sweater for a pickup truck.
The archduke's mustache twitched. $2,000,000, he said. Annabel shook her head.
"No, thanks."
$10,000,000,
shouted the archduke.
"Take it or leave it."
"Leave it," said Annabel. "I won't sell the yarn." And she didn't.
So that night, the archduke hired 3 robbers to break into Annabel's house, and they stole the box and took it to the archduke, who set off across the snow and sailed over the sea back to his castle. The archduke put on his favorite song and sat in his best chair. Then he took out the box, and he lifted its lid, and he looked inside. And it's empty. His mustache quivered. It shivered. It trembled. The archduke hurled the box out the window and shouted,
"Little girl, I curse you with my family's curse. You will never be happy again."
But, so he put the box on an ice float, and it floated all the way across the ocean, and there she is in her sweater with her dog, and it washed up on the shore. It turned out she was, and she just kept knitting, and now the tree is covered with a sweater. And so are all the cats and all the dogs. Life is beautiful. Everybody should enjoy life. Life is beautiful. Granny D says this all the time. Granny D lives in the heart of Harlem. I live on the other side of the city, far away from her, far away from traffic jams and taxi jitneys and the sirens smashing with the sound of the subway. But she doesn't let that stop her from seeing me on the weekends.
"You don't live that far, Missy," she says. "I don't mind those 3 trains and 1 bus for a hug from my favorite grandbaby. It gives me a reason to get out, a reason to live life, and life is beautiful." Every Saturday when the TV comes on and the coffee pot beep, 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 I rush downstairs. "Let's have a good weekend," Granny D says. For the next 2 days,
we live life, doing everything together. We watch TV. Granny D changes the channel. We take bubble baths. Granny D fills the tub with dish detergent. We kick back and relax. Granny D puts on our robes and paint our nails. You should always look your best, Granny D says. You never know who you might meet. Then we sit back and slurp Spritey Kool-Aid through a straw from a spiffy stemware. Mama snaps our pictures and posts them online. We nap, then jump on a bus, day tripping, watching the people, listening to the world, and eating our way through the city. This is living. Life is beautiful. And when the street lights come on, we head back home, hop into our 90s and pajamas, and hug each other until I fall asleep. But one weekend, no TV comes on. No coffee pot beep, beep, beep. And no Granny D waiting downstairs. I stick my head in her room, her bed still made. I turn on the TV, but no one changes the channel. I stand in the bathroom. The tub is empty. No bubbles. Granny D won't be coming, Mama says, and wipes her eyes with the corner of her collar. She fills the tub with water and bubbles. She's getting too old for the trains and buses. Mama wipes her eyes again, this time with the back of her hand. Her words like a sword, stabbing my tiny soul. I need to see Granny D. So I beg and beg and beg Mama to take one train and one bus and two more trains. Then we walk up the steps to Granny D's brownstone. The key is under the potted plant on the porch. She is lying down, her eyes half open, a nurse by her side. I kiss her cheek. I take my face in her shaky hands and kiss me back. I lie beside her and change the channel. She chuckles and then coughs. I wet the washcloth and wipe her face and arms. Then I paint her nails. You should always look your best, I say. You never know who you might meet. And when the moon peeks into her window, we snuggle and sleep. Me and Granny D, lying side by side, shoulder to shoulder, our breaths taking turns, exhaling. That Sunday morning, we wake to the AME Church Choir singing at Sunday service, the angels calling Missy, they calling me home. You're already home. Earth is a rented space, she says. Heaven is home. Day after day, week after week, Granny D stays in bed. I visit a lot with Mama. I paint her nails until she can no longer bear the smell of the polish. And one Sunday morning, while the singers at the AME church sang, Granny D waves her chipped polished fingers, closes her eyes, and lets her last breath escape into the air. Rest in peace, Mama says. The weekend after Granny D's homecoming services, the TV comes on, the coffee pot beep, 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 and Mama waits in the kitchen with two spiffy stemware. Let's have a good weekend. And we do. The TV watching, the bubble bathing, the bus rides, and eating our way through the city. And when we slip into our pajamas and kiss each other goodnight, Mama whispers in my ear, I enjoy myself today, baby. I smile and whisper back, everybody should enjoy life. Life is beautiful. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that I've been reading now for a couple weeks, titled The 57 Bus, A True Story of Two Teenagers, and the crime that changed their lives. One teenager in a skirt, one teenager with a lighter, one moment that changes both of their lives forever. If it weren't for the 57 bus, Sasha and Richard never would have met. Both were high school students in Oakland, California, one of the most diverse cities in the country. But they inhabited different worlds. Sasha lived in the middle-class foothills and attended a small private school. Richard lived in the economically challenged flatlands and attended a large public one. After school each day, their paths overlapped on the bus for a mere 8 minutes. But one afternoon, a single reckless act left Sasha severely burned and Richard charged with 2 hate crimes and facing life imprisonment. The case garnered international attention, thrusting both teenagers into the spotlight. But in The 57 Bus, author Dashika Slater shows that what might at first seem like a simple matter of right and wrong, justice and injustice, victim and criminal, is something more complicated and far more breathtaking. This true story, first chronicled in the New York Times Magazine by Slater and artfully, compassionately, and expertly expanded upon here, is a riveting exploration of race, class, gender, identity, mortality, and forgiveness, told with honesty and insight gleaned from both teens' lives. The 57 Bus will inspire you to rethink all you know about crime, punishment, and empathy. Okay, last week, Sasha talked more about being agender, not a boy or a girl. We ended with the chapter titled Sasha and Nemo. Sasha and Nemo. The call to evacuate came about an hour after students from Maybeck arrived in Yosemite for the school's annual camping trip. It was August 2013, just before the start of Sasha's senior year. The Rim Fire, the third largest wildfire in California history, was sizzling toward the campsite near Groveland, turning the sky a smoky orange. Sasha climbed into the back of a U-Haul-style truck with Nemo, who was a year younger. The truck was airless, hot, and cramped. We kind of died, Nemo explained later. We didn't actually die, Sasha said. We were both freaking out, Nemo said. That was our first date. The two of them were talking to filmmaker Lonnie Shavelson, who was making a documentary film about non-binary gender called 3 to Infinity. Nemo identifies as gender fluid. To me, gender fluid means I have the potential to be anything, any gender, at any time, Nemo explained. I can be male, female, masculine, feminine, neither, both. Like Sasha, Nemo uses they, them pronouns. Sasha and Nemo knew each other from the school's queer club and had gone to see Les Miserables together the year before. But after their ordeal in the back of the evacuation truck, their relationship changed, although neither of them was exactly sure how to define it. Both teenagers were shy and awkward, looking at each other more than at the camera. But they did their best to explain. Our relationship is, Sasha said, confusing, Nemo finished. It's a platonic relationship, Sasha said, but with elements other people might consider romantic. Cuddling and kissing and stuff, Nemo added, but it's not romantic. It's also non-sexual. It's like, take a regular relationship and instead of kissing, put cuddling and stuff like that. And instead of I love yous, it's like, you're the greatest. I'm aromatic, Sasha explained, so I don't really do romantic relationships. and I'm asexual, so I don't do sexual relationships, Nemo said. Our relationship sort of sprang fully formed on that camping trip or that fire evacuation, Sasha added. It just started happening. It was like, yup, this is it. This is how it works. We sort of stabilized each other or complement each other. In Homestruck, it's called Morale, a most important person, a soulmate, maybe, but not in the romantic sense. The fact that both of them identify as non-binary wasn't the reason they were together. It was just another thing they had in common. Part 2, Richard. Book of Faces. Pictures of Richard posted on Facebook, smiling beside his cousin's slit-eyed hilarity, deadpan in ladies, tortoiseshell sunglasses, at 14 in a beanie, round-faced, bright-eyed, at 16 jaw slack, brows raised, expression asking, what? Soft-eyed on a sofa, young brother cuddling on his chest. Standing with Skeet, spine straight, chins up, peas in a pod. And later, beside Skeet's picture, wearing a bandana in tribute. Mirror selfie, hand lodged in his waistband, not even looking up. None of it captures how he looks in conversation, how his eyes hold your eyes, seeing you see him. His own secret power, that paying attention. The smell, that is, the lemon pine disinfectant of just mopped floors, that is, new jeans, still chemical scented, pencil shavings, sweat, fryer grease, body spray, reeking bathrooms, weed smoke, morning breath. The smell, that is, the salty press of bodies changing classes, that is socks, that is feet, that is blood, that is bones, that is finding your way through halls and upstairs to a classroom filled with unnamed faces. That smell is the pungent eraser that wipes the whiteboard clean. So just ignore the ghost of last year's scrawl still there, still showing through. An old friend. Cherie couldn't believe it when she saw Richard at Oakland High School. Oh my God, she cried, hugging him. The two of them had grown up in the same apartment building over by 87th Avenue, a two-story tan stucco building with a couple of windblown Monterey pines in front. Back in ninth grade, they'd been inseparable, even though they went to different schools. Now they were juniors, and they hadn't seen each other for more than a year. It had been a terrible year for both of them. They were still broken. Maybe they'd never be fixed again. But it was so good to see each other, even depressed and hurting. Cherie sparkled. She was funny, sassy, and head-turning pretty, with creamy brown skin, long straight hair, and a perky, pierced nose. Richard was good-looking, too, round-faced and hazel-eyed, with a way of holding your gaze that could make you feel like you were at the center of the world. He was so light-skinned that people often assumed he was mixed, and he acted younger than he was. Hyphy, as they say in Oakland. Always smiling, always joking, always goofing around, whether or not it was the time for it. You don't want to be bothered. He'll just keeping talking to you. Keep playing to the point where you'll cuss him out and he'll still be laughing, Cherie says. He likes attention. He likes to bother you. He likes to play hit you, play fight with you, like, leave me alone. Oh my God. Around strangers, he was quiet, alert, fading into the background until he was just a pair of hazel eyes watching everything go down. But if you were his friend, then you were family to him. He called you brother or sister, and he'd be loyal until the sun quit rising in the east. He got on my nerves, but I loved him to death, Cherie recalls. He was my friend. I don't know what I would do without him. Miss Caprice. It was 3 weeks after the start of the 2013-14 school year, and a friend of Richard's was being sent home for fighting. She texted Richard to tell him, and he went to meet her at the bus stop. It was still the middle of the day, but he didn't care. He was a junior now, but back when he and Cherie were in ninth grade, they ditched school all the time, wandering through the city with their friends, looking for fun, courting trouble. He wasn't really in the habit of going to school all day, every day. But when Richard's friend showed up at the bus stop, she wasn't alone. She was being escorted by a petite woman with long black hair, dangly earrings, and a smile like a flash of sunlight. Her name was Caprice Wilson, and she was Ojai's attendance compliance officer. She didn't know Richard, but she knew he was a student, and it was the middle of the school day. Richard's friend needed to get on that bus and go home, she said, but Richard needed to get to class. Richard followed her back to school, peppering her with questions. Who was she, and what did she do? She seemed different from your typical school official. She had a homegirl vibe. I'm the truancy coordinator, Caprice said, and what happens is, if you miss a lot of school, then you're in an intervention program with me. So you try to help kids that's been in trouble? Richard asked. Caprice nodded. Well, that's me, he said. Can I get in your program? Caprice stared at him. Nobody ever asked to join her program. Students were assigned to it after they'd missed so much school. They were in danger of flunking out, dropping out, or getting kicked off the roster. She wasn't exactly trying to fill slots either. At a school with 1,875 kids, she had a caseload of some 800 chronically truant students. And if she was lucky, she'd be able to work with 275 of them in the course of a year. Yeah, Richard said, I want you to help me like you help them, because I've been to a lot of schools and I've been in trouble, but I'm really not a bad kid. Back in her office, Caprice looked up Richard's transcript. He was already a junior, and her program was meant for freshmen and sophomores, who are easier to get back on track than juniors and seniors. But it was clear he needed help. His grades were poor, his attendance spotty. Ojai was his third high school in Oakland. Plus, he'd spent sophomore year living in a group home in Redding, California, 3.5 hours away. He had been placed there by the juvenile authorities after being arrested for fighting when he was a freshman. Next time they talked, Caprice told Richard that if he worked with her, he'd have to learn a new set of rules. Once you cross over into this lane, you know what you'll be able to get away with, she asked him. He shook his head, puzzled. What? Nothing, absolutely nothing, because I'm going to make you understand the family motto. Never let your obstacles become more important than your goal. Right now, your goal is to graduate. And if you don't comply with the family motto, then just know I have a collection of belts in the back of my filing cabinet, and they're not for sagging pants. Richard laughed. I understand, he said, and grinned. The Princess of East Oakland. Caprice Wilson came of age in East Oakland in the 1980s when crack cocaine was just hitting the streets. For users, crack meant poverty. Whole lives stripped down like a stolen car. The parts sold off to pay for their next hit. But for dope dealers, crack meant power and respect. Fat wads of paper money, gold chains, and gaudy jewelry, fancy cars. Everything was in the moment, Capri says. No one thought about how it would affect our children. When she was 14, she saw a boy on a bike playing chicken with a car at the corner of 82nd Avenue and MacArthur Boulevard. The boy rode up close to the car, trying to freak out the driver. The driver swerved and tried to hit him. The boy on the bike dodged away and crashed into the curb, jumping over the bike and landing on his feet, grinning. "Damn, did y'all see that?" he asked. "He almost hit me." His name was Little Jerry, and he was 13. Caprice fell for him on the spot. The regard was mutual. Soon, they were talking on the phone every night. When Caprice went to his house for the first time, his sisters told him Little Jerry wouldn't stop talking about her. That's how she knew she was his girlfriend. Little Jerry had been claiming East Oakland's 69ville gang since he was 5 or 6 years old. He'd started out earning petty cash by ironing and rubber banding wrinkled money from dice games, and then moving up in the organization. But even after he grew up to be 6'2", he was still known as Little Jerry. By age 15, he was carrying around backpacks full of money. Too young to have a driver's license, he was already wealthy enough to own 4 or 5 cars. He'd like to go to Las Vegas to watch the fights wearing fur boxers and a long mink coat. 69ville was led by Felix Mitchell, who controlled much of the West Coast heroin market. He was arrested on federal charges in 1983 and sentenced to life in prison 2 years later. 14 months after that, he was stabbed to death by a fellow inmate at Leavenworth Penitentiary. His funeral made the national news. The casket, conducted through the streets of Oakland on a horse-drawn carriage, followed by a procession of 4 Rolls Royces, 10 white limousines, and an assortment of Cadillacs and Lincolns. Thousands of Oaklanders lined the street to watch the 8-mile parade. Caprice's mother wouldn't let her go. She didn't know that it was too late to worry about Mitchell's bad example. Violence skyrocketed after Mitchell's death as other gangsters battled for a piece of his turf, as well as the increasingly lucrative crack trade. Year by year, the number of murders climbed steadily from 114 in 1987 to 165 in 1992. The corpses weren't evenly distributed throughout the city, though. They were clustered on the east and west sides of town. East Oakland, in particular, was awash in crack, blood, and bullets. Caprice was living too fast a life to stay home, so she moved in with her stepsister's family. One of the girls' chores was to clean the guns. When boys came over, Caprice and her stepsisters would be sitting at a table with brush, rod, and cloth, expertly taking the guns apart, spinning the barrels, polishing the grips. A visitor would have to be pretty slow not to get the message. These girls were not to be played with. Little Jerry called her Caprice Classic after the car. He owned one of those, too. She got a bit part in a Jim Belushi movie called The Principal, and Little Jerry called her a movie star. She knew everybody, and everybody knew her. Little Jerry Cooper's beautiful, smart-alecky girlfriend. By the time I got to be 18 or 19, I thought I was like the princess of East Oakland, she says, because 69ville was the gang that had all the hype. It was the most feared. Caprice's brother went off to college in Atlanta, but Caprice had no interest. She tried junior college, but couldn't be bothered to do more than cash the financial aid check. When her brother handed her an application packet for Clark Atlanta University, she threw it away. No way was she giving up her East Oakland status just to go to school. Then an acceptance letter arrived in the mail. Her brother had filled out the application for her and mailed it in. "You're going," little Jerry said when she told him. But Caprice had another plan. She wanted to get pregnant. She knew she and Jerry would have beautiful children together. "How are you going to support a baby?" little Jerry asked. Caprice shrugged. "I'll go on welfare. That's what all the girls she knew did." "You sound so stupid right now," little Jerry said. "You know what's going to happen. They're going to kill me. And I do not want to have a baby out here without a dad. I don't want that for you, and I don't want that for my child. There will be enough of those kids out there. You can take those ones in. Just know that those ones will be your and my children together. And when they get crazy and out of control, help them, because they're going to need help." Little Jerry refused to sleep with her after that. "He froze me," Caprice says. He was like, "You're not messing with nobody else either. Try something else. I'll kill them, and I'll kill you first." So she went to college. She majored in education, ran track, and got an athletic scholarship, won an award for Student Teacher of the Year from the Dean of the School of Education. Once, when she came home during break, she learned that little Jerry had been shot 3 times. She heard it from a friend. He hadn't told her, didn't want her to know. But when she held his hand, she could feel a bullet lodged beneath the skin. It was clear the thug life was wearing him down. The violence, the danger, the vigilance. "We just need to stop the madness," he would say. "Just stop the madness." He drank too much, smoked too much weed. He began dressing like he was a blue-collar worker, jackets from UPS and Home Depot, a black brace like he had a job in a warehouse. He was 24 years old. In their world, that made him practically an old man. One day, he got into a conversation with an elderly woman who lived on 89th Avenue, a couple of blocks from his house. She wouldn't go outside because of all the drug dealing in the neighborhood, but she told him she wished she could have flowers in her front yard. He bought her some and planted them himself, put a little gate around them so they wouldn't get trampled by the customers going to the house next door to buy drugs. Paid attention every time he passed her house on the way to the store, which is why he had to say something when he saw one of those drug customers take a shortcut across the garden. "Man, did you see the fence was there?" he asked. "Why would you walk across the flowers? Just walk around. She growing some flowers." "I don't give a fuck about them flowers," the guy said. He didn't know who little Jerry was, just some guy in a puffy jacket. "Why you gotta be like that? Just respect her flowers." Now it was a challenge. "Fuck them flowers," the guy said. "I'm gonna come back and shoot this shit up." And he did. Or someone did. Within hours, little Jerry was gunned down on the sidewalk. Caprice had left just a few minutes before. She had been talking with little Jerry about what she was going to make for dinner. He said it sounded good. She promised to save him some. Afterward, 2 things stuck in her mind. One was how neat the shooting had been. It was one of the ones where blood went everywhere. There wasn't even a stain on the sidewalk. The other was how nobody on the block saw who did it. It wasn't like they were pretending they hadn't seen, the way people did when they didn't want to get involved. It was more like that bit from the Men in Black movies where bystanders have their memories erased. It seemed to Caprice like little Jerry must have wanted it that way. "I don't want anybody to retaliate," she imagined him saying. "I just want to leave. I'm ready." The killing, like so many in East Oakland, was never solved. That experience,
It really grew me up and taught me a lot about life, she said, 20 years after little Jerry's murder. Just appreciating the moment and doing the most you can do, you know, to help somebody else. Within a year, she had her first job as an elementary school teacher in East Oakland. The troublesome kids kept getting sent her way, the ones who had been kicked out of other classrooms. She knew these kids, or she knew kids like them, and she knew how to work with them. They were her children, just like little Jerry had said. The best mother ever. At Oakland High School, Capri served as a surrogate mom to the kids who needed one the most, the ones who had trouble just getting to school every day. Some of them, like Cherie, even called her mom, bringing her their grades, photographs, and artwork to hang on her walls, and writing her apologies when they ran into trouble. Her tiny office was papered with their missives. From son Oscar, "I love you, Mom," read one. "I'm sorry, Mom. She made me hecka mad," said another, written by a girl who had just gotten suspended for fighting. Caprice taught her kids to look out for one another, even when their inclination was to squabble. If a student wanted to be one of her children, they had to accept that they were gaining siblings as well as a mother. "We're family," she told them. "This is your sister. This is your brother. You have no say in the matter." On her walls, she had posted the family slogan, "Never let your obstacle become more important than your goal." The goals? Go to class, get your grades up, graduate, stay out of jail, survive. And unfortunately, this is where I'm going to have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with a fascinating novel titled The 57 Bus. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.